One, two.
Welcome to Culturetopia, your weekly lineup of the very best arts pieces on National Public Radio. I'm arts reporter Netta Ulibi.
And I'm Linda Holmes, the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll look at the complex career of Frank Zappa, HBO's latest must-see series, and reflections on Heath Ledger from Michael Caine.
We're going to start off this week with a books piece. Lit Neary usually covers literature or historical books or, you know, the kind of books that NPR readers like.
Absolutely.
This time, she looked at diet books. And the reason why is because it's a huge industry phenomenon. And no matter what, people will buy these books, even though they say essentially the same thing.
Maria Langer, a freelance writer and commercial helicopter pilot, seems like the kind of person who is nobody's fool. But she admits, over the years, she's forked over more than a few dollars on the latest diet book.
I bought in on the Suzanne Summers book, also the Zone books, South Beach diet books, and the Atkins diet books.
Now Langer says she is through with diet books. Writing on her blog, An Eclectic Mind, Langer said she bought one of this season's big hits, the Flat Belly Diet, and discovered nothing new inside. She felt like she'd been sucked in with promises too good to be true.
I just seemed to page right to the one page where this person had lost something like 30-plus pounds. And that kind of stuck in my mind. And also stuck in my mind was on the cover it tells you no crunches, you know, so it's telling you that you don't have to exercise. And it kind of lures you in.
You know, that is part of the formula.
Edward Ash Milby is a buyer of health and fitness books for Barnes & Noble.
The way they attract customers to the book is by having an interesting title and, you know, offering that promise. It's very compelling. I mean, how could you not want a flat belly?
Promises of quick results, says Ash Milby, are exactly what sell diet books. That and a lot of marketing muscle. And it helps to be a celebrity or to have a platform for promoting the book. Bethany Frankel is a chef who achieved reality show stardom on Bravo's Real Housewives of New York City. Now she has a best-selling diet book.
Hi, I'm Bethany Frankel. I'm a natural food chef, and my book is called Naturally Thin, Unleash Your Skinny Girl and Free Yourself from a Lifetime of Dieting, which is exactly what the book is. It's basically a book that is the be-all, end-all, never diet again book.
And that is the ultimate diet book promise. You'll never have to diet again. But of course, says Ash Milby, that's not how it usually works.
The diet category offers tremendous amount of repeat business because people, they'll hook into one diet, it doesn't work so well for them, and you just don't know how well they follow it, and then they find that there's another diet that sounds more interesting.
People want magic bullets.
Carol Lay knows what she's talking about. She spent her whole life losing and gaining weight, but it was hard to face the simple truth. She had to change the way she ate.
The first time that a trainer put me on a restricted diet plan, I was shocked that I would have to eat non-fat, unsugared yogurt. It was like, oh my God, I'd rather drink motor oil. I literally cried.
Now, Lay has her own diet book, The Big Skinny. A cartoonist, Lay tells the story of her ultimately successful battle against the bulge in pictures. In the end, the way she lost the weight and kept it off was simplicity itself.
I had to keep track of my calories and make sure I exercised every day because when I get into not wanting to look at the numbers, I tend to just slide down that slippery slope that's greased with fat and sugar.
But Julia Cameron believes it is words, not numbers, that provide the key to successful dieting. The author of The Artist's Way, Cameron is well known for her classes in creativity.
For 25 years, as I taught creative unblocking, I had seen that my students would become more lean and more fit as they worked with creativity tools. And so I found myself thinking, oh my God, this has been right underneath my nose. Writing is a weight loss tool.
You got it. Cameron says you can write your way to thinness. Her new book, The Writing Diet, has some standard dieting advice. Walk 20 minutes a day, drink lots of water. But beyond that, Cameron says you should take time in the morning to write down your thoughts and then keep an eating journal through the day.
Because what I have found is that all of these diets work until we stop working them. And when you have a journal and morning pages, you catch yourself as you head into a relapse and you go, whoops, oh, here I go. And it allows you to start over right then instead of taking the full tumult of the fall.
So when all is said and done, can any book really help the hapless dieter stay on course? Carol Lay thinks so.
This one can.
And you want to believe her. But somehow it's hard not to think, oh, all the diet book authors say that. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Julia Cameron's apparently needed another bestseller after all these years.
Yeah, I guess.
Someone too cool to need a diet book?
Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa was called a lot of things in his lifetime, but certainly not lazy. In fact, there's still unreleased music coming out more than 15 years after his death. It's part of an effort by his widow, Gail Zappa, to keep his legacy alive, but that's not the only thing she's doing, and some of what she's doing has attracted a little different kind of attention.
While other bands were enthralled with the summer of love, Frank Zappa saw a very different 1967.
What's there to live for? Who needs the Peace Corps? Think I'll just drop out. I'll go to Frisco, buy a wig, and sleep on Owsley's floor.
We're only in it for the money, but Mothers of Invention was one of two albums Zappa recorded that year. Frank Zappa was a 26-year-old self-taught composer, long hair and a funny goatee, when he walked into a Capitol Records studio in Los Angeles and handed out charts for Lumpy Gravy to an orchestra.
At one point, he turned to me when we were listening just to playback, and he said, did I write that? It was so shocking.
Gail Zappa is reissuing the rarely heard original recording of Lumpy Gravy, along with We're Only in It for the Money, in a package called Lumpy Money. David Frick wrote the liner notes.
I had never heard the original complete thing before, and it just blew my mind. It was almost as if he was writing avant-garde classical music in top 40 segments.
Lumpy Gravy is a suite of three-minute movements, and the music is not easy to play.
Oh, man. I wonder if I can go through this again.
Some of L.A.'s best studio musicians balked at the parts Zappa had written until he picked up his guitar and tossed off the sections written for bassoon and bass clarinet. Gail Zappa says musicians are still struggling to play what her husband wrote.
I want people to play Frank's music. Go ahead, try. Don't hurt yourself, but just try it.
But Zappa insists that anyone who does try to perform it in public needs to pay royalties to his estate.
I don't really care who's doing it, as long as they get a license. The people I'm going after are not licensing the music.
Zappa is going after cover bands she accuses of identity theft. Her lawyers have sent scores of cease and desist letters. But many of the people who continue to perform Frank Zappa's music say they don't need permission.
You or I cannot record that material and sell it for money. That's been made clear, but we can perform it.
And that's what guitarist Andre Chumley does in a long-running Zappa cover band called Project Object. Chumley says as long as the venues he plays have paid for what's called a blanket license from the performance rights organization ASCAP, he is not doing anything illegal.
I'm not a lawyer, but that is the opinion and the direction I've been given by probably a dozen lawyers at this point.
Music lawyers consulted for this story agreed, and it seems Gail Zappa has never actually sued a cover band, but she has sued a 20-year-old festival in Germany called the Zappanale for trademark infringement. She lost, but plans to appeal. By all accounts, Frank Zappa was a perfectionist who liked to keep a tight grip on his business and his art. As he told WHYY's Fresh Air in 1989, he struggled with symphony orchestras and his own bands to get his music right.
goal one for a composer is to just hear what it was that you wrote, because you like to listen to music as well as write it. That's always been the main thrill for me, is to come up with a musical idea and have it perform some way. And I'm especially thrilled if it's performed correctly.
That's why Gail Zappa has a problem with some cover bands.
Somebody goes out there, plays music, it's not played very well, it's not played anything like the composer intended, and they're telling the audience that's never heard it before that this is Frank Zappa's music, and it's not. It's some wretched version of it.
There are cover bands that the Zappa family does endorse, including Zappa Plays Zappa, a band fronted by Frank's son, Dweezil. Gail Zappa insists that she's not playing favorites, but some of the musicians who've been threatened by her lawyers have their doubts. They point to a message that was left on the hotline for Zappa's record label shortly after he died of prostate cancer in 1993.
Just play his music if you're a musician, and otherwise play his music anyway. That will be enough for him.
That's Zappa's daughter, Moon Unit. His widow, Gail, insists the message is not what some fans and musicians have made it out to be.
We wrote something for Moon to say on the hotline, but it was not a statement made by Frank. He never said that. He never told anyone that.
Ike Willis would beg to differ.
The main reason I'm doing it is because I love Frank. I love his music, and he asked me to do it.
Willis is a singer and guitarist who worked with Frank Zappa on and off for 17 years. He now tours with Project Object and other unauthorized cover bands. Willis says he talked to the composer a week before Zappa died.
He said, I would really like it if you could be one of the people that could actually keep my music played, you know, at least in some way, shape, or form. Those were his words. It's like he didn't want it to die.
There are performers who've decided it's simply easier to work with Gail Zappa. Students from the Paul Green School of Rock performed at Zappanale in 2005.
I could have swore hell was made of ray. Oh.
A few years later, Paul Green got a threatening letter from Gail Zappa's lawyers. He decided to negotiate.
I don't disagree with her right to do that, just her opinion on the matter. He wrote this music to be played. If Gail opened it up a little bit more, I think kids would really latch on to this music if it was more readily and easily available.
The disputes don't help the legacy, which is unfortunate.
Rolling Stone writer David Frick says Zappa's music deserves to reach a wider audience.
The legacy is something that hasn't been taken seriously enough since his death. In a way, I don't think people really do understand him. I'm still working on it.
So are other fans, musicians, and family, who all insist they want Frank Zappa's music to thrive. But that's just about the only thing they can agree on. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
You know, Linda, NPR had permission to post a couple of Frank Zappa's songs. I don't know whether it was cover bands or Frank Zappa originals on the website
sure.
as part of this piece.
Right.
And right after, a little notice appeared saying, NPR has been asked to take the music down.
Oh, is that a fact?
So we're going to go from one legacy to another. Michael Caine has been in over 100 movies. He's won 2 Oscars and Knighthood. But most importantly, he was on Talk of the Nation last week.
He worked with Heath Ledger on The Dark Knight. And he spoke a little bit about his early experience, his first encounters with Ledger. And he also spoke about his new film and a variety of other things. And you can hear the rest of that interview on NPR.org. But we wanted to play a little bit of it for you.
Yeah, well, Heath, I didn't know at all. I'd never met him before. And I only worked with him for 2 days on the sequence where he comes up in the elevator and bursts into the party that Batman and I are giving. I never had any lines with him because he was sort of addressing and haranguing the entire party. I was really in the background. So I only ever talked to him between takes, and I thought he was a wonderful guy. And I know you're supposed to say that when someone's dead, but we got on very, very well indeed. And I'd never seen the makeup before, and we talked about that, and I thought it was absolutely fabulous because I knew what they were going to try and do with it, made it look sort of old and as though he was sort of rotting, and it did it. And I had never seen his performance, you see. It was the first day in the first take. And then he went in the elevator and then came out. And I was completely stunned by the way he did it. I thought it was extraordinary. And I was very glad I didn't have any dialogue, because I think I would have forgotten it, because I was so stunned when he came out of the lift, when he came out of the elevator. That is the first time I saw the performance. And then, of course, I saw it for the rest of the 2 days, and we chatted about it. But I thought he was an extraordinary actor, and of course, an extraordinary waste. Everyone was so sad who worked on that movie. It was terrible. But for me, I thought he would win the Oscar, which he eventually did, because if you look at the opening monologue that he does and the closing monologue, they are absolutely extraordinary.
I stick a razor in my mouth and do this to myself, and you know what? She can't stand the sight of me. She leaves. Now I see the funny side. Now I'm always smiling.
That, of course, is a scene from The Dark Knight starring Heath Ledger as the Joker.
And you can hear the rest of the interview with Michael Caine on NPR.org.
Maybe you've read the hugely popular number one ladies detective agency novels by Alexander McCall. They've been made into a new series on HBO. They're set in Botswana, and they feature a character named Precious Ramotswe as the country's first lady detective. Every week, the ever-resourceful Precious manages to drum up a business for her fledgling agency, and in this episode, a husband has gone missing shortly after he's joined a new church.
Maybe he has found himself a nice young apostolic lady with better blankets than me. No, but...
He's a possibility.
It wouldn't surprise me. You know, I know he has many women friends, but when he joined this group, he promised he would turn over a new leaf.
Do you really want to solve this mystery? Even if the solution makes you unhappy?
What difference would it make? I'm unhappy now.
The voice you hear in that clip is Jill Scott, who is a singer and plays Precious in this show. And she's actually really, really very charismatic in it. And she is really quite lovely to watch. And this week on Talk of the Nation, African-American scholar Stanley Crouch talked to Lynn Neary about the depiction of the non-white characters on Number One Ladies Detective Agency as opposed to on other kinds of TV.
The problem usually is that, and it doesn't matter whether the director or the writer is necessarily white or not white, it's that there's a cliched conception of people who are not white that is often bought by black directors and white directors, black writers and white writers. So you don't necessarily get the range of human feeling that the main character Precious has in her responses to people, and you don't necessarily get the sense of humor that the show has, which is not dehumanizing to the person who's put in a comical situation. The person is just comical.
Yeah.
Okay, for instance, there's this African gangster played by Idris Elba, who travels around in his Mercedes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the glove compartment of the Mercedes, he has this little pouch of a purportedly magical combination of human bones and other things that are supposed to give him power.
Mm-hmm.
So see, in that one symbol, you have this Mercedes, right?
Right.
And in the glove compartment of the Mercedes, you have this little bag with this, you know, with this superstitious stuff.
So you got the two things right there in one.
Yes, like, and see, you see, very rarely do you ever see anything that so perfectly symbolizes the immediate present and the far past,
yeah,
and the fact that they both exist together.
So Count Stanley Crouch, among the critics who loved Number One Ladies Detective Agencies. Haven't seen it, but on Stanley Crouch's recommendation and Linda Holmes's.
That's right.
I'm now going to do so.
And from the colorful Precious Ramotswe to the colorful Jill Sobule, you know, often when a record label drops an artist, it's sort of the end of the road. There aren't any more CDs. There's no more touring. There's no more anything. But Jill Sobule took a little bit of a different approach and figured out a way to sort of spin a potential negative into a positive, took the rabid fans of the internet and used them in her favor to keep her career going after several setbacks involving her record labels.
And Linda, how did she do that?
Well, she set up a system where her fans could directly contribute money to support the making of her new record. She raised something like, it was well over $80,000, which allowed her to hire her producer and go forward with making the record.
So Jill Sobule was on Weekend All Things Considered, where they asked her to write a song to commemorate the 101st day of the year. And I haven't actually heard the song.
They asked her to base it around the number 101, so she wrote a song called Philosophy 101.
I am who I am today, Philosophy 101. Before class, we'd all get high, Philosophy 101. We think, therefore we are. I'm thinking here on NPR. I am who I am today, Philosophy 101. The teacher, he had crazy hair, Philosophy 101. I think he thought it made him look smarter, Philosophy 101. He used to hit on all the girls, I would always run. I heard the next semester he got fired, Philosophy 101. I didn't retain much of anything of Philosophy 101, but I did learn to bullshit all my essays, Philosophy 101. I never made it through to Philosophy 202, but I am who I am today, Philosophy 101.
So that's Jill Sobule with Philosophy 101, written especially for NPR. So I guess the question that is whether this model for musicians that she applied in this situation is sustainable going forward.
You know what I would suggest?
What would you suggest?
That she write a diet book.
Oh, there you go. That's perfect.
Or she could hold a fund drive. This is evidently a lot similar to what public radio.
I was going to say, I've heard people do that, fund drives. Speaking of people who are short of money these days, this is the time of year when the federal government asks you to pony up the money that you owe them for the year.
We had musician David Was on the air to offer some sonic relief. He gathered a list of music to try to take the sting out of paying your tribute to the tax man.
Recent developments in understanding the interaction between music and the brain might help us avoid the stress-inducing effects of sending one's hard-earned dollars to Manhattan and Detroit and Baghdad. With the right music in the background, preparing one's taxes might feel about the same as drinking cucumber water in a swank spa or doing Tai Chi as the sun rises over the seashore. Modern science may be able to explain in more detail the relationship between music and mood, but gents like Thomas Jefferson knew it instinctively. When he was stuck finding the proper language for the Declaration of Independence, he'd pick up his violin and play a bit, loosening the verbal side of the mind by avoiding its constant chatter for a spell. Albert Einstein, another amateur fiddler, claimed his immense brain power came from playing Mozart and Bach, whose solo violin music could even take the sting out of shock therapy. Music's effects on consciousness are by now beyond dispute, even when it comes to non-taxpayers like chickens and houseplants. Petunias seem to prefer Ravi Shankar to the Rolling Stones, and hens have been found to lay more eggs listening to Johann Strauss's Blue Danube Waltz. Speaking of breakfast fare, there were claims made by a rock-fearing minister in the 70s that raw eggs wound up hard-boiled when placed on stage during a hard rock concert. Curiously, the hash browns were unaffected. Back in the psychedelic 60s, I used to allay the effects of drug-induced paranoia by repeatedly spinning Miles Davis's In a Silent Way, a wafting, atmospheric piece of early electronica that drove images of Satan from my cerebellum. Equally relaxing are pianist Keith Jarrett's solo piano improvisations, which straddle the bucolic and the hypnotic with gentility and poetic feeling. But it's Samuel Barber's now celebrated adagio for strings that can simultaneously boost your alpha waves and express the sadness of sending your beloved greenbacks to build bridges to nowhere and fund pig flatulence research in Iowa. My prescription? Treat your ears well and forget about earmarks, at least till after April 15th passes.
So even if you are not a drug-taking chicken, supposedly, these are the songs that will help you calm down and get through the tax season.
Here at Culturetopia, we also try to straddle the bucolic and the hypnotic.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.